satisfied, but glorious to be celebrated, or at least you must celebrate the people who participated in them, whatever you think of them, but you shouldn't think of them, and you shouldn't say the word peace, because that's sort of treasonous. This is where U.S. culture, and I think to an extent Canadian culture, and in some other countries as well, are going.
Well, I guess I'm still reaching for analogies. I mean, to live without war right now, I mean, if people would say that's not possible, I think it's kind of like being in Alabama in 1806 or something like that, and somebody saying slavery is wrong, even though it's the cornerstone of our economy. This is, you know, it's the way of life. It's wrong, and it has to stop. And hey, that there is afterwards, there's another life after slavery. I mean, for we, the people that are ruling the economy, we won't disappear. So in the same sense, as war is the paradigm of our times for our economic activity, at least in the West, I think it's important for people to know that it can be changed, it can be gotten rid of, and we won't fall off the edge of the world without war. We can thrive and rise to higher levels as a civilization, as a global civilization, without it.
Yeah, I think it's a good analogy in many ways, in part for the lesson that of course, the people envisioning a changed world were right. And one could have said as much at the time with an ounce of intellect, but it's much easier to say so after the fact by pointing out to people that it's been proven right. I do think it's an imperfect analogy, as every analogy is. For one thing, because you probably didn't have a lot of people in Alabama in the early 19th century who were unaware of slavery or who thought that slavery was maybe 2% of the economy, the way you do today with war, where people are in large part, many people, not everyone, but many people are oblivious to the extent to which war is the leading industry and public project of the United States, the percentage of the budget that it swallows up, and so forth. It's not widely understood as existing to the extent that it does, and it's not as visible because, unlike slavery in your state, it mostly happens, you know, on other continents, thousands of miles away.
Mm-hmm. Well, and people in Canada still don't recognize the role that this country, all these years later, played in the slave trade, and how we did actually participate not just in sheltering slaves, but in owning them as well. Well, Dave, we only got like a minute or so to go here. Can you reiterate, please, designing a world beyond war, legalizing peace, the event that kicks off in Toronto?
Yeah, worldbeyondwar.org is the website. It is not too late to register and show up and participate. The conference on the 21st and 22nd in Toronto, with all kinds of great speakers and workshop leaders and organizations from around the world. It will also be live streamed. There are all kinds of other events happening in the coming weeks and months that you can find at worldbeyondwar.org, including Armistice Day 100 on November 11th, and a conference coming up in November in Ireland, bringing together people from NATO countries and the rest of the world to oppose U.S. and NATO bases and work on closing them. Get involved at worldbeyondwar.org.
Imagine that, 100 years after the war to end all wars, and here we are still, again, trying to end war. I'm really appreciative, David, of you coming on. You do so much media, doing this extra for this little show at the edge of the Turtle Island here. I greatly appreciate, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Me too. Keep up the great work.
When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favorite uncle that's taken you for walks in the park, ever, that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday. On today's show, former UN Assistant Secretary General and resigned head of the UN Oil for Food Program in Iraq, Dennis Halliday, on the continuation of a policy he's described as genocidal. Dennis Halliday and the UN's genocide by decree. Stick around.
Welcome to the program, Mr. Halliday.
Thank you, Chris. I'm delighted to be on Guerrilla Radio.
Well, now, there's been some disturbing developments this week in Iraq, developments that have a peculiarly familiar sound. Events that led up to the Gulf War sounded very familiar. You were at the UN when the war began in 1991. Can the UN stop a repeat of what happened then?
Well, the UN failed miserably in the 80s and the 90s. The difficulties between Iraq and Kuwait were well known at that time. The problem of debt, the debt burden, the low price of oil, which was undermining the Iraqi economy, already shaky from the Iran-Iraq war. But, you know, the whole thing was in the hands of George Bush, and the plan to destroy Iraq was already drawn up, and the need to have him enter Kuwait and therefore be destroyed clearly was on the cards, and there's nothing the UN could do about it. And as you know, while the Security Council discussed peaceful withdrawal, the American bombing of Baghdad began.
Now, that bombing, this wasn't an illegal action to begin with, now, was it?
Well, the bombing of Iraq in that period was covered by, I suppose, the existing resolution, I believe it was 661, which was designed to get Iraq out of Kuwait. And as we know, as I said, there were many peaceful endeavors to try to get that to happen. There were proposals on the table. King Hussein and others worked very hard on this peaceful process. But clearly the allies of the United States and the United States had no intention of going for a peaceful solution. I believe James Baker at the time was extremely alarmed when he thought that a peace might break out and Iraq would withdraw. So I think this was all part of a bigger plan to destroy the one regional power in the area that had potential, and that was too frightening, I guess, for those, particularly the United States and Britain, who wanted to control the Gulf and oil supplies.
Well, there's been assertions that there was never the intent to dislodge Hussein as the leader, but just to cripple his military capabilities.
Yes, I tend to believe that, because clearly in 91 the capacity to demolish the regime was there, but the forces held back. Furthermore, as you may recall, George Bush encouraged rebellion in both the Kurdish north and amongst the Shia in the south of the country. When those rebellions broke out, American troops were still in the country, but stood back and facilitated, in fact, the Baghdad suppression of those risings with the loss of life in the thousands in both ends of the country.
Well, they effectively abandoned those people, making them believe that they were going to come in and help them dislodge Saddam Hussein, and then were torn to pieces.
It was a complete betrayal, that's quite right.
Now, since the war ended, or at least the shooting stopped, well, I can't even say that because the bombing continues to this day, but can you explain how the UN tried to facilitate this embargo and what the goals were?
Well, the UN, under a resolution called 687, imposed a new resolution after the withdrawal of the Iraqi forces, the retreat from Kuwait. This resolution has been considered by international lawyers for a long time as not proportional to the requirements. The requirements were simply the disarming of Iraq of weapons of mass destruction after all the evacuation had been accomplished. And it is a devastating, the mother of all resolutions, I think it's called in Baghdad, but it imposed on Iraq a total, complete embargo of activity, cultural, social, commercial, business, and so on, which has demolished the well-being of this country, destroyed the economy, destroyed the value of the dinar, and has destroyed the people of Iraq. The middle class, the professionals, are now struggling under massive inflation, something like 800%, I believe. Many have left the country. The school system has collapsed. Infrastructure has been destroyed, first of all, by the American bombing, and then by the absence of electric power, spare parts, and adequate resources to rebuild. So we have this appalling situation now of a vast high level of child mortality and malnutrition rampant throughout the country.
Well, now, your career with the United Nations spanned some three decades. You walked away from all that when you were reaching the height of your influence at the UN. Just why did you decide that, no, I can't change this within the system?
Well, Chris, I spent 30-some years in the development business working for UNDP, primarily in Southeast Asia. That was my area of focus. And I worked also in New York as the head of human resources for the UNDP and then under Boutros Ghali for the UN itself. I wanted to be in Baghdad to make a difference, to get my hands back where I think I was most useful, but found out very quickly that the so-called Oil for Food program was badly designed, and perhaps intentionally so, to appear to provide some support to the starving people of Iraq, but nevertheless was underfunded, was overly constrained by the Security Council, and did no more than sustain the high levels of child mortality and malnutrition throughout the country. Now, I set about correcting that, and during the first 6 months, we managed to get the Security Council to more than double the size of the program from 4 billion gross to over 10 billion gross. So we made some movements, but after 9 months or so, I realized that not only was I being associated with this genocidal program in the country as head of the United Nations in Iraq, but that I was no longer free to speak out and speak my mind, which is a frustration for many civil servants, including international civil servants. I was in the process of being reprimanded by the Secretary General, and I felt that I needed to be free to speak out, just as I, in fact, am now doing on Guerrilla Radio.
Well, maybe you could tell our listeners just what the conditions are. You've been to Iraq. What is it like for the Iraqis right now?
Well, the Iraqis are effectively refugees in their own country, being inadequately fed and supported by their own money from this Oil for Food program. There's a professor in near Calgary called Sheila Zurbrig, who is a historian of famine conditions, and she feels that we have sustained famine in Iraq under the United Nations since 1961. We now have the average birth rate of babies in Iraq under 5 pounds. That itself is a famine indicator. We have child mortality rates running at 131 deaths over 1,000 live births. The comparable figure in Canada is probably about 6. We have massive malnutrition, chronic and otherwise, throughout the population. We have a collapsed social order with high levels of divorce, broken families, children out of school, children on the streets, the poor families being forced into begging, crime and prostitution. It's a complete breakdown of all the high standards of life that the Iraqis enjoyed under the Ba'ath Party in the 70s and 80s, when Iraq had a standard of living, education, healthcare, employment record comparable to southern Europe. So the United Nations, the guardian of the Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, has deliberately and consistently over a 10-year period destroyed the well-being of the Iraqi people. It's the United Nations, unbelievably, that has destroyed their basic human rights.
Well, now, we hear over here that Saddam Hussein is rebuilding his army, he's building palaces and all the rest with what money he does make, and he's just letting the people scratch around. Is there any justification in the belief that, well, there's plenty of money, but it's just being ill-used?
Well, don't forget the vast bulk of income for Iraq is channeled through the United Nations, and all of that is being well spent, or not being spent at all, because it's actually stuck in the United Nations under the constraints of the Security Council. But $9 billion has been spent so far and delivered out of a total revenue of about $30 billion from oil sales in the last, what, 2-3 years. The revenue available to the government in Baghdad from other sources is the business across the Turkish border, the business across the border with Jordan, both known and approved, in a sense, by the United States, and, of course, the illegal movement of crude through Iranian waters. This entire endeavor may bring in about $500 million or maybe even $1 billion per year. Now, $1 billion per year divided by 23 million people, it does not, in fact, make a huge, significant difference. But nevertheless, this money, in my view, is not, of course, being well utilized. It's going into, I dare say, supporting the Republican Guard. Some has been wasted on shaping up and improving palaces or whatever. But the fact is, why would we expect a higher standard of expenditure behavior on the part of Saddam Hussein than we do of Mr. Blair in London, who wasted $1 billion on some dome, or Mr. Clinton, who wastes $300 billion on the Pentagon budget, while Americans have very little health care, great pockets of poverty in the United States. We have 12 million American children going to bed hungry every night. So, you know, to make Saddam Hussein into some sort of saint and expect high standards of behavior is unrealistic, in that he is a dictator with a very doubtful reputation and a very brutal reputation of atrocities against the Kurds and what have you.
Mr. Hussein's got a very fine pedigree. He fits right in with a lot of other dictators that the West have placed on the throne, doesn't he?
Well, you see, the West pretends that it supports democracy. Of course, this is not the case. The West supports stability, and stability leads to investment. Investment leads to nice, fat profits. So whether it's Suharto or Mobutu or Pinochet or many other characters, now people who run Saudi Arabia, what's his name, who runs Kuwait, they're all of the same breed, and these are not people that really care about the human rights of their own people.
Now, you've been painted in the press since walking away from the UN and going public as a bit of a radical, somebody with an axe to grind. What about your, can you tell me a little bit about your, the person who took your place, Hans von Sponeck?
Well, let me say, first of all, I mean, I have no axe to grind. My only interest, and I'm totally independent of anyone else, is the children and the people of Iraq who are paying the price or being punished by the United Nations member states for the mistakes of their leader, Saddam Hussein. Now, my replacement was a man called Hans von Sponeck, an old friend of mine, actually, also with the same background as myself in development. He stayed there for about 16, 17 months and also resigned in protest. He felt that the new resolution, which is now 1284, which replaced 687, is unworkable, continues the famine and starvation conditions in Iraq, and he was unwilling to remain to run this program, as he and I both had done, because he didn't want to be culpable for a continuing regime of death and destruction. He may not use the word genocide, but that is in fact what we have on the ground today, and genocide sustained by the United Nations, if that can be believed. It's almost incredible.
Well, I've heard it described as a slow motion genocide. Now, how can we bring to heel the people that are perpetuating this? I mean, if the courts are all run through the UN, how what charges can be laid on people if this is a genocidal policy, which it certainly is by all definitions of the word?
Well, you're quite right. The Security Council is a power unto itself. I mean, it's a totally corrupted, undemocratic institution, now thoroughly manipulated, you might say corrupted, by the United States with the support of Britain and some of the other permanent members who are not, I'm afraid, much better. There's a major need for reform. This Security Council needs to be reworked so that there's a proper representation of North and South and make it a more democratic institution, abolish the veto and so on. In the meantime, of course, we have this problem, and there is one way to begin to look at it. Decisions of the Security Council can be taken to the World Court, the International Court of Justice, through a two-thirds majority process of the General Assembly. But, of course, you can visualize that's an extremely long and difficult process to go through. And it means that many member states of the General Assembly who value their relationship with the United States for reasons of power or trade or preference or whatever are reluctant to jeopardize that relationship over the people of Iraq, about whom they may care, but they have to put the priorities of their own countries before the Iraqis. And that is that's the way it all works. And that, of course, is the tragedy of the fact that we now lose 6,000-7,000 innocent Iraqi people every month.
Well, what is the level of support among the nations that make up the General Assembly for this kind, well, not only the embargo against Iraq, but of Cuba and some of these other extreme measures?
Well, against Iraq, I think you'd get 95% of the member states of the UN General Assembly voting against the continuation of the embargo on the people of Iraq for the obvious reasons of genocide and so on. Economic sanctions themselves are covered in the sense by Chapter 7, Article 41 of the United Nations Charter. It doesn't make reference to the word sanctions, but it provides the arrangements whereby pressure can be brought to bear on a member state who is not behaving consistently with the other provisions of the United Nations Charter. Now, what's happened in the case of Iraq is by sustaining this provision under, as I said, Article 41, the United Nations itself, is undermining the charter, and its actions are incompatible with the principles and purposes of the United Nations charter itself. And in addition, of course, to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Well, I picked something off the web today, and it was talking about Article 54 of the Geneva Convention. What is apparent is that during the war, the Allied countries deliberately targeted Iraq's water supply, knowing that without a clean source of water, they would fall prey to all manner of diseases. And how does that fit into, does the Geneva Convention hold any sway at all with the Security Council?
Well, sad to say, it doesn't seem to be the case. And this performance, of course, was repeated in the case of Yugoslavia, mm-hmm. where, again, power, water, and sewage systems were destroyed in Belgrade at one stage. No, the practices of the Gulf War would have to lay charges of crimes against humanity at the door of George Bush and the generals running the Allied regime of destruction. They're completely in breach of the Geneva Conventions, as you say, Article 50, 54, mm-hmm. which is designed to protect civilian populations against bombing runs and other military activity, which is detrimental to their well-being. And as Ahtisaari, the then next president of Finland, said at the time in 91, we the United Nations and the allies of that war had put Iraq back into the pre-industrial age.
The old bomb them into the Stone Age line, Barry Goldwater made famous.
Just about, yes.
Now, Madeleine Albright was asked if she thought that the death and misery being caused by this sanction campaign was worth the effort. She seems to think it is. Is there any indication of when enough is enough from the United States?
Well, that's what we're all looking for, I guess. And to this day, most of us can't really understand how Madeleine Albright can justify this death of 500,000 children in 1996. And that figure is obviously way out of date. It's now considerably higher. She herself, I believe, is a grandmother. And if these were American children, I think we'd bring this thing to a close very quickly. So it raises some very ugly issues of perhaps racism, anti-Islamic thinking, and a general lack of caring about people in distant lands, far away, in a part of the world with which we're not all, you know, thoroughly familiar. Plus, it indicates perhaps the willingness to pay a horrendous price for the self-interest of the United States, the control of oil and oil revenues, the need to dominate the Gulf and the Arab states of the Gulf area, including Saudi Arabia and Kuwait itself. I mean, it's a nightmare. It's horrendous. I think most of us just can't imagine how we could sleep at night knowing that we continue to sustain a program which continues to kill 6,000 or 7,000 innocent people per month.
Well, now the oil prices, everyone's complaining out here in the West about high oil prices. Does this benefit the Iraqis at all, that the price of oil has shot up?
Well, of course it does, because Iraq has limited capacity to pump oil. It needs spare parts, it needs new wells, and that is not being facilitated by the United Nations under this program. Therefore, their limitations are now being rewarded in a greater way, given the high price of oil. Of course, the price of oil in Europe, which, of course, is horrendously higher than the United States, is due to tax, not due to the actual cost of production. In this country, I think in the United States, the taxes are about 22%. I believe in Britain, it's 85% is tax. So I think the Arabs are perfectly justified in sustaining a price of $25 to $35 a barrel. This is a non-renewable resource, after all, and providing the money is well used and invested for the future. I mean, this is the way they should go, knowing that oil is not going to last forever. The issue is, of course, with the sort of governments we have in much of the Arab world, I'm afraid the money is not being invested in the people and not being invested in their future.
Well, we saw last week the Millennium Summit at the UN, and there was a lot of talk about reforming the institution. How did that progress, firstly, and what do you think are the most important priorities in reforming the United Nations?
Well, I think we have to start at the top, and the top is the Security Council, where the real power lies. And the Council today reflects the 1945 end-of-the-war situation when five nations were the victors, and those victors made sure they would build the UN, but they would control it henceforth. And they gave themselves veto power, and they gave themselves permanent seats, and they determined by so doing that they themselves would never be attacked by each other or by other member states of the organization. So that's why we find today, for example, that the horror of Chechnya has never even been placed on the agenda of the Security Council. Likewise with Tibet. So we have this appalling situation where there are two standards being applied, and this clearly must change. Secondly, we have a situation where the South is not represented in the Security Council effectively. So one of the suggestions is that we'd go out for a system of regional permanent seating, so to speak. So Sub-Saharan Africa would have a permanent seat, as would, say, Latin America and so on. And the nations of those regions would then elect one of their own to sit in that permanent seat for a 5, 6, 7 year period. That would immediately change the decision-making process and give better balance, certainly north or south. But of course, removing veto power is going to be extremely difficult. And we've been talking about it in the General Assembly now, I think, for 6 or 7 years, and there's been absolutely no progress. And I think the leaders from the permanent members did not discuss the issue at all, I think, during the Millennium Summit. But others, like Mr. Castro and others, raised it as a real concern for other states throughout the world.
Well, what can smaller countries like Canada or Ireland or even Cuba, what can they do to have their opinions acted on in within the UN?
Well, see, I believe they can do a great deal. Canada has a very high reputation amongst UN member states. Canada can work with countries like New Zealand and Ireland and many others who feel that this policy, in the case of Iraq, is not just, not acceptable, cannot be justified, is genocidal or is horrific or whatever word they want to use, and can work outside the Council and put together a coalition of member states who then would convince or put pressure on Washington and London to drop this policy in favor of something more civilized, to end the killing and the punishment of the children of Iraq when, in fact, I guess the target is really Saddam Hussein. This does not mean they have to break the law. They can still abide by the Security Council resolution in the meantime. But there's nothing to say they can't work towards a better solution than the one we currently have, which has totally failed and which has resulted in appalling conditions. Now, I shouldn't perhaps have said failed. If you speak to Scott Ritter, who should know, he will tell you that Iraq has no military capacity whatsoever today to endanger its neighbors, has no weapons of mass destruction whatsoever, or nor the capacity to produce them whatsoever. And therefore, in fact, what we wanted, I guess, under Resolution 687 has been accomplished. There is no justification for keeping this pressure on Iraq, except, sadly, the statement made by Washington repeatedly that they will never lift the economic embargo until Saddam Hussein is no longer in power. That's not a UN resolution. That's a view of Washington, perhaps echoed by London sometimes.
Well, now that brings us to NATO and people going outside of the United Nations. The attack on Yugoslavia last year, and now there's rumblings that should the elections being held over the next week in Yugoslavia not go the way the West likes it, they might go thundering in again. Can the UN do anything to rein in NATO?
Well, I mean, I think we saw a demonstration of that problem when NATO was used instead of the United Nations to deal with the problems of Kosovo. I saw in, I think it's the new book written by William Shawcross, he refers to NATO as the army of the rich. And clearly that's what it was used for, and the damage was appalling. The investment was wasted. If we'd put a quarter of the expenditure on military endeavor into the people of Kosovo, we probably could have done a much better job in terms of prosperity and having people work and live together as they have in that part of the world for many, 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 many years. There's no way one can control NATO. I mean, NATO is controlled by the United States, which is the only superpower and has all of the connections and power and authority that allows for it to dominate not just the United Nations, but also NATO, but also globalization and WTO. We have a problem, clearly, at the moment, but that's going to pass, and let's hope that we can do better in the future.
Well, Mr. Halliday, there's so much more we could talk about, but we don't have time. But for those people that do want to hear you speak, you're going to be coming to Vancouver September 23rd. That coincides with the election in Yugoslavia, by the way. You're going to be at the First Baptist Church, 969 Burrard Street in Vancouver. The meeting's at 7 p.m., sponsored by Campaign to End Sanctions Against Iraq. And you're also going to England. What kind of reception do you expect in England?
Well, I've spoken many times in Britain, the universities, and I've also been in the Westminster meeting with members of Parliament, House of Lords. There's a huge interest there in changing this policy. I think many British people are embarrassed by the support of Washington.
Well, I wish you good luck. Thanks a lot. Former UN Assistant Secretary, UN Humanitarian Coordinator for the embargo against Iraq, resigned. Thanks for being on the program, Dennis.
Thank you very much.
For 40 years, the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, a.k.a. SFPIRG, has been helping students build communities at SFU. Campus organizations like Out on Campus and Embark developed out-of-action groups at SFPIRG. Action groups are one of the ways that student activists can take action for change. Visit us at www.sfpirg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca to learn more about starting your own action group today.